Welcome to Life Solved, the research podcast from the University of Portsmouth, where we explore how studies here are changing our world today and in the future. I'm Robin Montague, a writer at the university. This time we ask, what is the reality of radiation? For many, when the word nuclear is mentioned, it brings up images of weapons, bombs, or power plant disasters. And in the summer of 2023, concerns were raised over the Fukushima nuclear power plant decision to release its wastewater into the ocean. So this seems the perfect time to discuss the truth behind the headlines. Jim Smith is Professor of Environmental Science at the University of Portsmouth.
If this had been any other site in the world, it wouldn't have got any media attention, I don't, because it's kind of normal. But I think people associate anything that happens there with the terrible and undoubtedly terrible aftermath of the accident at Fukushima. And we tend to conflate those two things in our minds. But what this new nuclear release is has nothing to do with that original release during the accident.
Over the next 20 minutes or so, we'll explain why the likes of Fukushima should cause us very little concern. But the misinformation online and in the mainstream press perhaps should. Let's start with a thumbnail sketch of radiation itself. It's easy to forget that it's part of the history of our universe and has been around much longer than us humans have.
Radiation is something that comes out of nuclear power plants, or the sun produces lots of radiation because the sun is a giant nuclear fusion reactor, as well as lots of elements that are in the Earth's crust produce radiation. So radiation is what comes out when radioactive elements undergo radioactive decay. In other words, something like uranium has been around in the solar system ever since it started, but every now and again, a uranium atom will go pop and it'll give out a radioactive alpha particle or beta particle or a gamma ray. And so there's lots of radiation in our environment around us, coming from the sun, coming from the soil, but also there's what we call artificial radiation, which is radiation that's produced in nuclear reactors and can get into the environment.
And that's a challenge with public perception. There's what we might consider good and bad versions of it.
People tend to be a lot more relaxed about natural radiation than they are about artificial, because natural, we associate it with natural things, which we generally tend to think are quite good for us. Artificial, we associate with terrible things like the Chernobyl accident, like the Fukushima accident, like the terrible atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So we associate human-made radioactivity with all these terrible things. We're not quite as worried about natural radiation, even though the levels in the environment of natural radiation tend to be almost everywhere much, much higher than artificial.
This natural radiation can come from the soil beneath your feet and the buildings around you, but also from so-called solar winds, particles from heavenly bodies as close as the sun, or as far away as the deepest reaches of the Milky Way. So it makes sense that those of us on higher ground get exposed to more radiation than those of us at sea level. But how does this get measured?
We measure radiation amounts in a thing called a microsievert. So a microsievert is a dose of radiation. So when I go to Chernobyl and do field work, I take a badge which tells me how many microsieverts of radiation I've got while I've been there. And it's usually very low, and much lower than the natural radiation dose I get. So for example, in Portsmouth, we get about 2,400 microsieverts of natural radiation every year from the air around us and the cosmic rays and things like that. Many people in Cornwall could get 5,000 or even 10,000 microsieverts, depending on where they live, because the rocks are different and they have different amounts of natural radiation in the rocks. Air crew could get 2,000 or 3,000 microsieverts extra because they're at high altitude for a long time, so they're not protected by the Earth's atmosphere from all the cosmic rays. So natural radiation doses can vary depending on your job and where you live.
Talking in thousands of microsieverts does sound like a lot, but rest assured, unless you're heading well over the 10,000 mark, you've got absolutely nothing to worry about.
The aim for members of the public is not to get more than 1,000 extra above the natural radiation dose. So that's what, after the Chernobyl accident, areas were evacuated more or less on that basis of getting not more than 1,000 to 5,000 microsieverts extra above the natural background. When I go to Chernobyl for 2 weeks and do field work, I get about 100 extra microsieverts. In theory, it still gives me a risk of getting cancer in later life, but for me, that risk is very, very low and much less than if I went for a few months to Cornwall. And so I think it's acceptable.
Let's take you back to the 26th of April, 1986, when the number 4 reactor at Chernobyl nuclear power plant suffered an explosion. Over 35 years later, many of us would still think that Chernobyl is a no-go area, but far from it.
The whole exclusion zone at Chernobyl is about 4,000 square kilometres, so it's quite a big area of land. But only a small proportion of that, you would say, well, I really wouldn't go there for too long, or I really wouldn't want to live there. There are hot spots where there was more deposition of radioactivity after the... So there was an explosion, then a fire that lasted for 10 days. And depending on where the wind was blowing and the weather conditions, some areas got quite significant radioactivity. So there's an area called the Red Forest. And it's called the Red Forest because it died after the accident, or most of the trees died from the intense radiation. And that's about 6 square kilometres. So it's a tiny fraction of the whole area of the zone. But there we wear a badge, we make sure we're not there for too many hours. I wouldn't live there because the radiation still, it's 100 times less than what it was immediately after the accident, but it's still very radioactive. But there are other areas of the exclusion zone where people can and do live quite happily. So we've got colleagues who work in Chernobyl and they live for 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off in the town of Chernobyl, which is 10 kilometres south of the reactor. And they're living, going about their daily business. There's also old people, and it tends to be old people who stayed, and they said, we're staying in our homes. They're fine. And when you look at the radiation doses that they're getting, they're not living in the most contaminated part of the zone. They're getting about 2,000 to 3,000 microsieverts of dose extra, which is within what we expect from natural radiation.
It's worth remembering that Chernobyl was in the country we call Ukraine today. So whilst access to the area is more limited in 2023, it sounds like Jim had quite the time there pre-war.
I've swum in the cooling pond at Chernobyl, so the reservoir that held the cooling water for the reactors. And I knew what the dose was, and I knew it was insignificant. And I sort of did it just to sort of prove, yeah, that's fine. Whereas I wouldn't go camping in the Red Forest. Some people do, some unofficially. Some Ukrainians used to go and just say, I'm a big, tough man. I will go and camp in the Red Forest, the most contaminated area. But I wouldn't do that because it's a significant dose.
What about wildlife, though? You can put restrictions in place for humans for their own well-being, but wild boar, red deer, wolves and others were able to roam freely after the disaster. Well, it turns out that the animals are doing very well without us.
They had 35 different routes of about 10 kilometres length each. And we took them and we reconstructed the radiation dose on each route. And what we wanted to find out was, is the abundance and diversity of mammals different in the more contaminated areas compared to the less contaminated areas? And we didn't find a difference. And then we compared the mammals in the Chernobyl zone with mammals in other nature reserves in Belarus, and we didn't find a difference. The only difference we found was that the wolf population at Chernobyl is 7 times higher than in other nature reserves in Belarus, and that's not because the radiation's good for the wolves, but because the human interference is less. And so the lesson from Chernobyl, it's had a huge impact on people, not least from the evacuations and the worry and the economic damage, but the natural environment is more abundant and diverse now than it was before the accident.
If you're enjoying Life Solved, the research podcast from the University of Portsmouth, then you might like one of our other episodes. Now in its 13th series, there's a wealth of stories to be explored and information to be understood over more than 100 episodes. Back in 2022, Professor Victor Becerra explained to us how nuclear reactors work and why they're getting safer.
It is well known that safety in nuclear power plants is of paramount importance, and these plants are designed for safety. But as many other technological endeavors, they may be subject to problems occasionally. And having an awareness of the presence of faults is important, because then with that awareness, appropriate actions can be taken.
That episode, along with all the others, is available to stream for free wherever you listen to your podcasts. We've taken a look at the Chernobyl accident of the 1980s, but more recently, Japan's Fukushima plant has been getting the headlines. On March 11th, 2011, an earthquake and tsunami left the nuclear reactors unable to cool effectively, resulting in radioactive releases in the surrounding environment. Thousands of people were evacuated from the area. Some argue that the evacuations caused more harm than good. Whilst the situation wasn't as bleak as was the case at Chernobyl, Fukushima is on the coast, and as a result, there were concerns for the marine ecosystem. But there's a reason the power plant is making headlines once again, a story that has been well over a decade in the making.
Fukushima's been in the news recently because it's been storing, since about 2012, all the radioactive wastewater that's generated on the site. So that's water that's been used to cool the reactors, and water that's been pumped from groundwater, which became contaminated after the accident. So all that's been stored on site in about 1,000 giant tanks, all of them containing 1.3 million cubic meters of radioactive wastewater. And now that water's been treated, so it's been treated to remove almost all of the radioactive elements, but what's left is being discharged into the Pacific Ocean, because the Japanese say they can't keep on accumulating and building more and more tanks, so they've taken the decision to start discharging that into the Pacific Ocean.
Unsurprisingly, there has been huge concern over this. Jim understands the worries, but can assure you it's not nearly as bad as you might think.
It sounds scary. 1.3 million cubic metres of radioactive wastewater going into the ocean. It sounds terrifying. And so a lot of people interpreted this as being a really dangerous thing, and it could lead to risk of, if you consume seafood products from Japan, there could be a risk. Or if the release of the water could damage the marine ecosystem of the Pacific. Those were the claims. But in fact, the truth is a lot more reassuring than that, I think. So what's left in the water, so the Japanese have a very efficient water treatment process that takes out almost all the radioactivity except an element called tritium. And tritium is a radioactive form of hydrogen. So what happens in nuclear reactors all over the world is that a tiny proportion of the water that flows through the reactor gets turned into what we call tritiated water. In other words, instead of being H2O, one of the hydrogens gets replaced by this radioactive form of hydrogen, tritium, and it becomes HTO, tritiated water. And the problem that everybody has with tritiated water is that it can't be chemically separated from ordinary water, because it behaves exactly the same. It is water, it's just got a different form of hydrogen atom in. So what nuclear sites all over the world do is to release that into a river or lake or into the sea. And that's what the Japanese government decided to do at Fukushima. And it's no different than anyone else does, except that because it's Fukushima, there was a whole uproar about it and claims of major risk to the Pacific and major risk to seafood consumers, which weren't at all founded in science.
And how does this treatment process work?
So the water gets treated by a thing called ion exchange. So it gets filtered and then it goes through a series of giant columns that have substances in that will chemically react with the radioactive isotopes in the water. The isotopes then get attached to the solid phase of these tanks, and then the water, it doesn't pass through. Once that absorber is kind of used up, it then needs to be buried as radioactive waste, but the water coming out of it is almost free of radioactivity, apart from this thing called tritiated water. And so that the amounts of other things that are in the water, there are still tiny amounts of other things in the water, but once the water's gone through that treatment, and then when it goes out the pipeline, it's diluted 100 times, so the tritium levels will be 2.5% of the Japanese limit for discharge, and the other radionuclides levels will be less than 1% of the limit. And those limits are already quite cautious in terms of the radiation doses that people get from eating seafood and so on. And so when the water goes out the pipeline, the tritium levels are 7 times lower than the World Health Organization drinking water limit for tritium. So in theory, if it wasn't salty, you could drink this water when it comes out the pipeline.
But that doesn't stop the headlines, certainly on social media. You might have read stories about how the water releases could contaminate the whole Pacific Ocean in under 2 months.
Of course, we know that when water goes into the ocean, then it's going to go all over the place. It's going to go all over the world. But what matters is how much there is. And just to give you an idea of that, so that the Japanese have now done one of the releases of wastewater and they've done monitoring. And that monitoring's checked by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And it can be checked by anybody because anybody can go and get some water from around there. It's not like you can hide it very easily. They've measured 251 samples of water within 3 kilometres of the pipeline. And only one of them came above the detection limit. And that detection limit is quite low. And so after that first release, of course, there's tritium there because it's gone in. We know it's gone in, but it's even very hard to find, even within 3 kilometres of the pipeline, let alone across 1,000 miles of Pacific Ocean. And the fish have been sampled as well, and no tritium's been found in the fish. Although some of it will get in, but it's really, really low. And it's much lower than what's already in the fish from other natural radioactive elements in the fish.
We all know the perils of inaccurate information being spread far and wide on social media. But what of the regular news organisations that we would normally know and trust? It seems that, unintentionally, they haven't always served us as well as they could.
There's lots of great science journalists who want to get the story right, and in general, in my opinion, they've got it right, more or less. But there's also lots of news journalists who don't know the science, and they just see the headlines, and they see claims by various people that this is a big risk. For example, China has claimed that this is a huge risk to the Pacific Ocean. So we measure radioactivity in becquerels, the amount of it. So Fukushima is planning to release 22 trillion becquerels of tritiated water every year. And it sounds like a lot, but there's a nuclear site in China that releases 180 trillion becquerels every year. There's a nuclear site in France that does reprocessing that releases 10,000 trillion becquerels of tritium into the English Channel. And the French have measured the fish and the radiation doses, and they're still incredibly low. So what really matters is not... We can't say there's zero risk, but that risk is so insignificant that it's nothing to worry about. And certainly when you put it in the context of real environmental problems in the Pacific, so the Pacific's under threat, no doubt, from climate change, from sewage inputs from all countries in the Pacific, from overfishing, from plastic pollution. When you put this Fukushima release in the context of those, it just doesn't register.
So given accurate and well-explained facts, the public can make up their mind and make their decisions based on the evidence. In his continued quest to prove the low levels of risk, Jim's gone one step further. From swimming in a Chernobyl cooling pond, as you've heard, but also helping create an alcoholic tipple. A drink that has raised over £30,000 for the people of Ukraine.
We've produced a schnapps from Chernobyl made from apples that are grown in the contaminated areas at Chernobyl. And we spent quite a lot of time working with a community in a town called Naroditchy, which is in what we call the second zone. So it's not abandoned, but there's no official use of agricultural land there. So there's a school and a council and shops and things, but there's no investment officially allowed and there's no official use of agricultural land. And so we've been doing a project to say this land can be used again. And as part of that, we studied the transfer of radioactivity into crops 35 years after the Chernobyl accident. And we found that the crops were still slightly contaminated. They weren't super dangerous, but they were still slightly contaminated. And then when we distilled them, we couldn't find any radioactivity in the distillate, in the product that we'd made. And so we set up a social enterprise called the Chernobyl Spirit Company to produce and sell a kind of apple schnapps, or we call it an eau de vie. It's a bit like a vodka, but it's still got the flavour. It's not distilled to such a high level as vodka, so it's still got the flavour of the apples. And we're selling that in the UK, and the profits we're making are going to support the community in Naroditchy.
And there's my Christmas shopping sorted. This won't be the first time on Life Solved, or indeed the last, that we discuss misinformation on the internet and beyond. Sometimes the disinformation can be state-led, but often it's a result of people not fully understanding the facts behind the story. If you've been concerned over the release of the wastewater from the Fukushima reactors, we hope you're less worried after hearing this episode. Why not kick back and relax, perhaps with a glass of atomic apple schnapps? Thanks for listening to this episode of Life Solved. You're very welcome to be a part of the discussion. Email us at lifesolved@port.ac.uk. That's lifesolved, one word, at port.ac.uk. Tell us what you think and make suggestions for future episodes of Life Solved. And we'd love if you clicked follow on your podcast app so you never miss an edition. We'd also really appreciate it if you left a rating or a review as well, as it helps us get these conversations into more ears around the globe. If you've been inspired by this episode and want to support our research, like Jim's in the School of the Environment, Geography and Geoscience, then head to port.ac.uk/lifesolved to find out how. You can also find out how to work or study with us. Next time, we take a trip to the seaside to discover why countries need their coastal communities.
Any sort of holiday destination is a place where you can sort of forget where you've come from, forget maybe some of your troubles and so forth. But the English seaside is interesting. I think the amusements are a central part of it, but also in some ways the kind of defiance of the weather, which I think is a real part of the English seaside, you know.
Bye for now.